folks. Welcome to another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast of the Armchair Dragoons. And we have a motley crew of Dragoons with us here tonight. Back again, we have our good buddy Cyrano. Howdy, Jim.
Hey, good evening.
And if Jim is here, Doug must be here. Howdy, Doug.
Good evening.
And special guest, first time on Mentioned in Dispatches with us, from the Great White, is it still the Great White North, Rex?
The snow has finally melted. It did about a week ago.
Okay, so the great no longer white North.
Brown but not quite green yet North.
Gotcha. So our buddy Rex from up there in Montreal, and here for a very specific purpose for tonight. And a couple of weeks ago, when Jim and Doug and I were together on a previous podcast, one of the things that came up was the issue of some of the civil military considerations in wargaming. And Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, the term you used there was sweat, right?
Correct.
So that was, what was all that standing for again?
See, now that's the thing. It's sewers, water. I'm going to have to find.
Electrical. Wasn't the E electrical?
Yeah, it's, it's funny when you have.
This is your job.
I know it is, but these people come into my briefings, and I bring in people, and hopefully they tell me these things. You know, it's that's at least usually the way we do it. But I will.
Sewer, water, electrical, something, and trash. I don't remember the A. Maybe it was and.
No, it's actually sewer, water, electric, and telecommunications.
Okay.
That's it. I just found the latest briefing sheet I got on that. So it's sewer, water, electric, and telecommunications. And these are things that when you work as closely with municipal government as I do, the folks that train us in emergency readiness think about at a level that most people don't. When I worked at the Renaissance Fair for a bunch of years, we actually had a running joke that people visiting from the 21st century to merry old England in the 16th had no idea how grateful they should be for sewers.
Yeah.
And the fact that, and yeah, the conversation was basically that we have, that we, when we do a lot of these games, especially those that try to treat modern and imagined futures, that they really do need, if you're going to try to take it at anything above the tactical level, to start thinking about the impact on urban centers of sweat.
And Doug, there was a particular game from Ty Bomba that I think we had talked about and was kind of the entry point to that whole conversation. Do you remember what it was off the top of your head?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I really don't. Well, I remember we talked about Ty, but I don't remember which game it was.
So somewhere that...
The game is War in the Megacity.
Okay. And somewhere in all that, part of the conversation came up of, hey, you know, one of the games that where these things are such a big deal, as well as medical considerations, was Aftershock, which is not a war game, but clearly heavily influenced by those. And you know, a game designed around training folks to help with disaster relief situations. And that's when the light bulb went on for all three of us kind of simultaneously. And we said, hey, we need to call Rex.
And here I am.
And so we spoke his name three times, and then we emailed him and asked him if he could appear. And so Rex, in the email exchange we had lining this whole thing up, you know, I had mentioned Aftershock because obviously it was the one I was familiar with. You had mentioned, is it We Are Coming, Nineveh? Is that the?
Yeah. So, I mean, Aftershock, these kinds of issues are right at the core of Aftershock because obviously it's a game about humanitarian assistance and disaster relief after an earthquake. And as you will know, because you were there and you helped in the process, it started at Connections US, 2010, long time ago. But the reason we did the Haiti earthquake is we were deliberately choosing something not kinetic to throw, you know, a challenge at war game designers and say, you know, let's brainstorm what a game would look like about something that the military does, but in Aftershock, there's no shooting at all. There might be some looters. there often aren't, but it's not kinetic at all. Now, We Are Coming Nineveh is a game about the Iraqi security forces' recapture of the city of Mosul in 2017. It actually originated in my conflict simulation design course at McGill. Two students, Julia Lemonez and Harrison Brewer, it was their class project, and then subsequently Brian Train and myself worked with them to develop it. So it'll be coming out with Nuts Publishing in a year or so. That's an interesting sort of foray into this topic, because it's a very kinetic game about a very bloody block-by-block fight in West Mosul. But you lose the game potentially by not paying enough attention to the damage that you are doing to the city. So collateral damage is a way that you can lose the game. It's one of the metrics that we track. And you have to decide, do I really want to use that artillery there? You know, it'll be quite effective, but the cost may be severe. Do I want to invest in things that go boom, or do I want to invest on better training around the rules of engagement? Do I want to allocate some of my Iraqi police units to humanitarian assistance rather than combat operations? And even the event cards that come off are a lot of tactical vignettes of, you know, a car heading towards the checkpoint that won't stop, but it might have fleeing refugees in it, civilians in the line of fire, informers, local guides. You know, the civilian population constantly permeates that game, because Mosul was a big, grinding, you know, 3-month West Mosul fight into the old city in a population city of 1 million people.
So, quite a mess, quite an ugly fight, and obviously these are really important considerations in the battle. How did the students, what kind of research, what kinds of things did they investigate when building the model for the non-kinetic engagement component here?
Well, the genesis of this was that Juliet was doing a paper in another course on the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, and it came across the Battle of Mosul, which didn't have many PMF units in it, actually, and pushed Harrison into designing with it. I mean, it's very clear that it was one thing to get ISIS out of the city, but you had to try to get ISIS out of the city in a way that didn't so alienate the Sunni population of Mosul that you had ISIS back again in a month or two or three, because obviously relations between the Sunnis of northern and western Iraq and the central government of Baghdad in the Shiite-majority central government of Baghdad are not great. Now, in fact, the damage that was done in Mosul was terrific, but there were choices that had to be made, and weapons that at times couldn't be used. And one of the things that's core to that game is that when you get into the fight in the old city, it's street-by-street, house-by-house fighting, which means you've got to use your leg infantry units. You can't blast your way into the old city at the end. It's not politically sustainable. It's militarily difficult. And you now see why, you know, the Iraqis relied particularly on the counterterrorism service, the Golden Division, to do that fighting in the end, because, you know, you can't go blow up the core of your city in your attempt to liberate it, although they did make rather mess of it.
I think that was something that we saw with the Russians in Grozny. If you read some of the after-action reports from there, they wanted to blast their way through. Their answer was, you know, very few dead guys shoot us from under the rubble. So that was sort of their approach there. So, Jim, obviously nobody's trying to conquer Milwaukee. I mean, creatures are trying to eat Sheboygan. But,
right.
But I don't know that Milwaukee's going
to... It's a great civil-military game. We need to showcase that game. I still love it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, it was one of the first games I discovered, actually, believe it or not, on my current passion, my current love, Tabletop Simulator. There is a wonderful mod for the creature that ate Sheboygan, so I'm very happy.
So, I don't recall, because it's been probably 40 years since I've played it. I don't think you're needing to rebuild the sewer infrastructure of Sheboygan after the creature devastates it.
No, but things catch on fire and you've got to put them out. Right? You
know, yeah.
And you can eat the fire units if you're the monster. So.
Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, that's a double bonus, because you get the health points, as I recall, but you also slow down the firefighting effort. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And they're spicy, too.
That's what I hear.
So
those guys are big into chili cook-offs.
Yes, yes. So, Jim, in your day job, Obviously, you know, occasionally you're doing whatever emergency management sorts of things. The kinds of considerations that Rex is talking about having being built into something like, you know, We Are Coming Nineveh. Look, if there was a bird flu outbreak in a big city somewhere, it's real easy to just quarantine everybody and say, look, nobody moves. I won't say it's easy. It's easy to make that decision to declare we're just going to lock everybody down. But at some point, the trash starts to pile up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, the thing I'm most directly involved in is the thing they call COOP-COG, which is continuation of operations and continuation of government. And we have gone back and forth really since 9/11, tell you the truth, because there has been this consistent fear that the building I work in, City Hall, would be a target for some attack. Thankfully, we haven't been, and we were doing just fine, thanks. But you do think about it, and you do talk about it, and you do try to discuss it in this context of COOP-COG. And the first thing that I said to folks, including our Homeland Security Director at the time, was, okay, what's the threat we're talking about? Because you really have to sit, you have to build the scenario based on the threat you're responding to. That sounds self-evident, but it's not to people. It was one of those moments that I realized, holy cow, ConSims and PacSims, with respect to the current guest, really do teach you an organized way of thinking about these sorts of problems and adapting courses of action and thinking about things on a scenario basis. Because, yes, it is certainly more likely that the city of Milwaukee is going to be confronted by a four-day snowfall that leaves 4 feet of snow on the ground and immobilizes all standard forms of transportation.
Yeah, Rex calls that Tuesday.
Understood.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, and down by where you guys live, you know, when it turns 50 degrees, when it turns 10 degrees below, we're looking for the heavier coat.
Yeah.
So, it's all relative, I suppose. But it's more likely we're going to get a weather event. But nonetheless, we did ask, we started to work our way through scenarios like, what if, you know, we are a major water supplier? What if someone conducts some sort of an attack against our water supply? What if, you know, because it is so central, what if somebody tries to shut down the government? You can, there are people who will laugh and say, hey, so much the better. But one of the things that we talked about was, for 3 to 4 days, can the government function and can the world move on without it? Of course. But as time moves on, certain essential functions that are performed by a government, and that's why this, you know, We Are Coming Nineveh is so interesting. Because I always wonder, in a modern era game, you know, how much infrastructure was in place in Mosul even as this fighting started. You know, whenever, and I think it's something that affects anybody that watches the war in Syria. I said, wait a minute, you people are living here? Do you have running water that's clean? Do you have sanitary services of any kind? And I'll leave telecommunications to the side, but to your point, Brent, do you have waste disposal?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and modeling and building, baking that into the cake, for us, that's a primary thing, because we may have hid American submarines in the Milwaukee River during World War II to save them from what? I know not. but, you know, let's face it, and I'm fortunate in this, I'm not worried about a military attack, but an attack on that infrastructure is a very real thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you were talking about figuring out on a scenario by scenario basis what's the threat we're facing and then build it out from there. Doug, it sounds kind of like the CPXs we run at Origins with the teaching the abbreviated version of the MDMP, huh?
Well, it's definitely a piece of that. And I think Jim is very right that a lot of the value of ConSims and PacSims are developing a mindset, developing a way to think. You know, certainly I deal with it every day as well in what I do, because we have to do lots of scenario-based planning to consider not even, you know, that somebody's deliberately doing something. just that it's going to break, you know, because that happens. Computing systems are one of the most entropy-prone creations in human history. They just break.
Yeah. They break sitting still.
they do. So, you know, you have to go through that exercise, which is very much like the same kind of, you know, the parallels from CPX games, the parallels from anyone who plays these games with any level of seriousness are really there. Now, what I think is interesting is the times that we've maybe tried to make that point to people that have attended some of these things and tried to draw that broader, hey, you know, think about how this maybe applies in some capacity that's not just the game. You know, there's a lot of people that are just not interested in drawing that lesson.
Yeah.
But you can. Certainly Jim's point about attacks on infrastructure, I mean, that's, I think one of the things today as we start, and we kind of talked about this last time with modern games, it's possible to have an attack that is totally non-kinetic now, right? An attack on your infrastructure through some kind of electronic, you know, cyber attack. It's not kinetic from the perspective of nobody's actually shooting anything, but the potential fallout and damage of that, particularly if you cause something like, which is suggested to have happened, an oil refinery to explode. You know, you're actually causing physical damage in that kind of scenario. And so I think we have to start, you know, it's interesting to see systems that start to examine that can happen and how to react to it and how to plan for it. And it is going to be an interesting, you know, I think it's going to be an interesting part of the hobby from a non-professional wargaming perspective as we start looking at future sims that have to incorporate some of these things because they're going to be very real world. But boy, that's a really, really different game than, you know, NATO Warsaw Pact 1982.
Yeah.
Well, I'd add too that I think a lot of hobby games, I mean, it's in some ways quite easy to model the kinetic stuff because we know how to do it and we have a lot of other games to inspire us. There was an interesting, not really an experiment, but a study done by Defense Research and Development Canada on Matrix games in which they played ISIS Crisis. It's a scenario for Iraq versus ISIS, but it's a Matrix game, so the players are not bound by a particular type of move. Right? They can do whatever they think is the most important thing to do at the time. Now, the scenario is a very kinetic scenario. Mosul's just fallen. ISIS is on the march. You have to deal with them. And in those games, I just looked at the data before we started talking, half the moves were non-kinetic moves. Because it's a game where if you want to make a political move, you want to make an economic move, you want to do something else, you want to issue a fatwa, you can do it. And so those games are suggesting, and as a political scientist, I think they're right on, that half the fight against ISIS in Iraq, of the major decisions, of the most important thing to do at any particular time when jihadists are coming down the road towards Baghdad, didn't involve the application of things that go boom. You know, half of it was something else. But most war games, you know, we sit there with a hex map and some chits and we're moving them around and we're all very comfortable with that being the main show. There's an awful lot of other stuff going on.
You know, it's interesting, Doug, you mentioned that, a lot of the civil considerations don't get brought into something like a NATO Warsaw Pact game. World War II is one of the most gamed topics ever in wargaming, and you know, most of us just have visions of Patton flying across, you know, central France or the big, you know, clashes out on the East Front. And yet there's two great examples from the movies of these very real world civilian considerations. You know, one, in A Bridge Too Far, when John Frost and the group set up at the base of the bridge in Arnhem, they just move into somebody's house. You know, it's just, hi, we're here, we're taking over your house. And they're in the city, and the city becomes this kind of free fire zone, but, you know, the folks that live in the house are still flushing toilets. They still got to get food from the market somehow. You know, there's the famous fairly bloody scene where, you know, grandma finally gets fed up with it all, puts on her beret, and she's going out shopping or whatever when the Germans shoot her. But, you know, those were real things that were happening even in World War II, and we just sort of wave our hand over them all and just kind of pretend they didn't exist in any of the games we have going on.
Well, I mean, let's face it, from a hobbyist, you know, from a hobbyist perspective, if you're playing a game about Case Blue, and a big part of the game is to somehow acknowledge and cope with the enormous civil impact of that campaign and the enormous civilian casualties. And you're doing this, again, we're talking about from a hobbyist perspective.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody playing that, man. That's
no.
That's nope. A bummer, right? That's not now. Those things happen, and they really should be acknowledged. And frankly, it's one of the reasons that I really can't bring myself to play World War II games anymore. Is I've always got in the back. But for the average person, nobody wants to sit there and think about, yeah, I'm having this, you know, chess-like kind of match. I'm doing this on a Sunday afternoon to have fun with my buddy. And oh, let's take a minute to acknowledge, you know, 20 million Soviet casualties.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just take a minute on that. You and I fought a battle from combat missions, Final Blitzkrieg, in which, you know, your job was to lay a village flat.
Right. And I did so quite effectively.
Right, because I was hiding in it.
Right.
You know, and when you think about things like that, we talk about, as we talk about kinetic warfare, more traditional views of war games, yeah, we even if it's, and it's not abstracted out, it's modeled.
Right.
You know, rubbling a house and blowing up a blowing, and in fact, if you go to combat mission, there's different ways for the buildings now to blow up in that engine.
Right.
You know, they can crumble, they can explode if enough damage happens. If you take 6 inches of step back from it, you sort of go, huh, how did that happen? And you start to have that, but, you know, those things, those effects on populations, well, you don't have to be modern to talk about that. I am watching it's on Amazon. Go check it out. There is now a Russian show, I guess we call it a documentary history program, on Napoleon's 1812 campaign. And it's got some very, very interesting stylized set pieces where it's almost as if they use computer rendering, but they don't try to move them. They set up dioramas, and they just move around them at various angles and driving, or just to try to give an illusion of motion or action. But they do a wonderful job of talking about the logistics of Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. That army, you're talking 500,000 men moving the way that they did, the logistical pain, and that's probably the wrong word, the sweat pain, may I? Although telecommunication doesn't apply. The infrastructural impact on the surrounding area of that army was a horde of locusts that would not be seen again until 1941. And we just never, ever, we throw it into a diro modifier, like in the classic War and Peace. Well, if you're on the Spanish board or if you're on the Russian board, your attrition roll is 1 point higher. Or, you know, you have to, you know, do this in a certain amount of time or your supplies run out, all that stuff. As Doug said, there is no game. You know, one of the points they make is Napoleon takes Lublin with no contest. The Tsar just drives away and leaves. Nobody is playing the looting Lublin game.
Right.
Or nobody is playing the they burned my city game. That just doesn't bring people's interest.
Although,
but that had a profound effect. And going back to the game that we're under discussion, that had a profound effect on the overall outcome of that campaign.
Yeah, just a quick shout out here that for This War of Mine, which came out in 2014 or so. Uh-huh, it's a digital game, but of course there's a board version of it too, where essentially it's a fictionalized siege of Sarajevo, and you're just surviving as civilians, in which you really actually have to build a still for water supply and you know, go find food. It's a very depressing game. It literally models the depression, right? I mean,
that was kind of the point, though, right?
Difficult decisions. You just start going to bed all the time and rocking in the rocking chair and maybe go and kill yourself. But we should make the losers of every time you blow up a city or a town in a conventional war game. You should have to play through a campaign of This War of Mine, so you just inflict it on the poor civilians.
That's a really good point, and. It's really, I don't know, man. I mean, we start this discussion really sort of looking at it from the perspective of the mechanics of the game and, you know, why you would want to examine some of these factors and how they add realism and how they can be tools for planning and things like that. But in relatively short order, you are up against the whole issue of the ethics of our hobby as a hobby, you know, that can, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to talk about it, period, because they just want to move their, you know, their German and Soviet counters on a map board and have a chess-like experience without considering those things. And I get it. It's a game. That's what they want to do. But there is that thing always underneath there.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I mean, we've seen in the hobby people sometimes get quite animated when people introduce the question Scramble for Africa recently with GMT Games.
Yeah.
About how sensitive something is treated. In the hobby, there are people in the hobby who get very upset to even have that conversation. Now, I've lectured on war game design both for the UK MOD and for NATO, in which there is an entire session on ethics in war game design, on issues of sensitive treatment, gender, class, how do you deal with atrocity, how do you make sure that your participants who may have gone through PTSD-inducing things, you're not re-triggering that in the game. How do you handle things like rape as a weapon of war? And when I do it with professional military audiences, they all think it's an important, sensible topic to talk about. I've never had anyone say, why are we talking about this? It's all, you're right, we should think about this. You know, we should think about how our audience is going to react. We don't want, we've got game objectives. You talk about it in the hobby, bizarrely, it's much more sensitive than the people who actually deal with this stuff in the real world.
Well, and some people will argue, and I certainly respect, I will share my one thought about Scramble for Africa that I shared with Brandt. It's a very simple one. I don't know who ever let the Flashman simulator game cross anybody's desk. You know, I saw the art for this thing and I went, ugh! But that entirely beside the point. Your point that you're raising, I think, goes to the fact that, as is so often the case, the people you're talking to or lecturing to are the ones that actually have to face those real-life consequences.
Right. Exactly.
You know, for them, it has a weight. You know, I started out, my love of wargaming came from two broad sources. One was watching older guys play 25mm Napoleonics in a basement, where it was shuffling soldiers around in a horrifically bad set of rules, talking smack to each other and drinking beer. Most of them were ex-military. A bunch of them were cops. They were just having a good time. It seemed like one of the most social things with all these incredibly cool minis. And the other is the spirit of Cracticus Potts' Grandpa Potts in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, where he and the brigadier line up a bunch of toy soldiers on a floor and hurl a disc at each other. You know, it's an entertainment, it's a light thing. But when this becomes real, and that's the thing about it, is you do, to Doug's point, you do sort of sort of subdivide these things, I remember I was going, I'm a certified clerk, and I was taking clerk certification classes, and one of them was on disaster preparedness. We have to do that, you see. And the guys that were teaching the class, I was just sitting back at the back of the room. It was a big room filled with like 200 people. We were going on this drill, and I realized, to Brandt's earlier point, holy cow, you guys are running a CPX. You know, you're actually doing a command post exercise, and what you're asking us to do is create courses of action and all these other things. The skills in the real world that we tease out of here have to be done with that same level of ethical severity. And, you know, when we make these decisions, you know, they put to us in this disaster drill an ethical question. It was, you've got to make a choice, because of limited resources, because the disaster is so vast, between a hospital whose generator has failed and an old age home where their generator has failed. Which do you go to first?
Yeah.
You know, which, what do you do? And how do you plan for that? And what are you going to do knowing you don't have the resources and never will?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So when you make real life choices like that, yeah, there's a lot of stuff when this stuff becomes real that you suddenly can't abstract out.
Well, I think, you know, it ultimately goes back to Doug's point of, why are we playing these things? And if it's to have fun while learning some history, there's not a lot of fun in those topics that you were talking about, Rex, like the, you know, rape as a weapon of war. Nothing fun, right? There is no way to make that enjoyable at all. And so, of course, the hobby guys are going to be, you know, hold up their silver crosses and, you know, try and chase you to the back of the room with a clove of garlic. It's like, no, we don't want that. That's not fun. That's not enjoyable. But again, I think in that overlap between what is fun and what can be used for learning purposes, that those are some very real considerations that you need to think about while building in the engagement of other parts of those interactive lessons. I think that's definitely a case. You talk about, you know, bringing in some questions about law of war and the ethics of what we're doing. The very first connections that I ever attended was in Dayton, was in 2010 in Dayton. I think Aftershock was 2012, I think, is when we did that one. The 2010, I was one of the panel co-chairs, and I brought in Pete Bogdazarian, who's the designer of the Core Command System, designer of Tank on Tank. He's got a couple of other games out there. And Pete's day job, Pete is a lawyer. And it was funny, it brought him in to talk about sort of state of the art of modern wargaming. And one of the things that he was talking about was how rare these kinds of ethical questions are approached in civilian wargaming at all. And it was a little funny because he got up to introduce himself and he said, you know, as a lawyer, he's like, I don't want to put any of these things on PowerPoints because I don't want them to come back to haunt me later. So, and the crowd wasn't really 100% sure whether they were supposed to laugh at that or not, which is kind of what you expect when you have a lawyer up there talking to you. But he just had a little steno pad with a handful of notes on there, and he talked for 30, 35 minutes or so around ethical questions in wargaming, because we were, our panel was the state of the art of civilian wargaming and how some of these things were missing and how they were important and could be discussed in civilian wargaming. But he ultimately came back to a very similar point that we're making here, which is, it's not a lot of fun in that. And so if you're playing the hobby for pure enjoyment, it's tough to find the fun in that. And, you know, Rex, you guys are doing this in a design class where there are a variety of academic lessons coming out of this, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I recognize, I mean, a lot of my gaming is around peace and stabilization operations in which the key questions are just the ones that were identified, triage, you know, the limited resources, having to make really difficult trade-offs in which there's not a good answer, there's not a right answer and a wrong answer. There's kind of a whole series of more worst and least worst answers. So yeah, I mean, a lot of my gaming is obviously bound up with the teaching into it. Well, one interesting thing though, there is downloadable content for the ARMA digital games on laws of armed conflict, which is really interesting. And you might ask why just for ARMA, you don't see that with other first-person shooters and what have you. Well, of course, Bohemian Interactive puts out the Army series. They also put out BBS.
Right.
So they're quite interested. And that whole community that plays the Arma series as hobbies tend to be people who are interested in the realism of the military operation, including someone saying, no, you can't bring an airstrike down on that target. There's people there. So it is interesting in the commercial hobby world. Some of the best stuff that's been done on Laws of Armed Conflict has been done by Bohemian Interactive because it's part of their the military side of the business for them, as well as the hobby side of the business.
I was very curious, Rex. I'm here looking at your PAX Insight, as I often do. And one of the comments that you make about We Are Coming Nineveh is, the game is thus, you've made a series of good points, able to combine low complexity and hence be accessible to even neophyte wargamers. And then you say, with a rich and detailed treatment of this important battle. I will absolutely believe the second half of that sentence. But one of the things that Doug and I talk an awful lot about, and we've gotten into this with Dr. Sterrett and even Brandt a little bit, Doug and I are sort of wandering into this camp that there's wargamers and then there's people who ain't wargamers. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine. You don't have to be a wargamer. God knows. But there's this idea that war games can reach over this fence and coax over a substantial number of these people that have entered this incredibly rich hobby game resurgence. What do you really think are the odds? And I've got a bunch of the games from Nuts. I like Urban Operations and some of the others. But what do you think the odds are that you're certainly going to get my – I'm going to buy this thing. There's no question. You're going to get a lot of other individuals that are going to buy it in the community, but then it's going to lap out into that broader hobby gaming community for a topic like this.
Well, I don't think that the liberation of West Mosul is a topic that's got a general gaming interest in liberating West Mosul from Daesh. That being said, it is a really easy game to play. I use Urban Operations too. Actually, I use it for teaching. Students are confused about things and those rules until the end of the game. With Nineveh, it's usually about 15 minutes, and they've worked out 95% of gameplay. I mean, it's very simple area movement, very simple block combat. To some extent, it's an easy thing to do. In Urban Operations, you're having to model things right down to where the windows are. Yes. We Are Coming Nineveh, it's neighborhoods in an area movement, because that's how the thing was fought. It was, it'll take us 2 weeks and we'll finally break it into this neighborhood. So it lends itself to a very simple game system. So that game system wouldn't work for other kinds of treatments. But I will say, not just because I'm one of the designers, because the original designers were two of my students, it is super easy to play. It is super easy to play.
Have you played Battle for Baghdad?
I have, and I dislike it intensely. largely because I don't think it models the things it's supposed to model. I think it's a game system with Chrome added on top of it to make it sound daddy.
Okay.
I mean, that's a game where the NGO player can use weapons of mass destruction.
Yes. No, that's right. I noticed that the first time I played it. I bought that game at Gen Con. And I was sitting at, I bought it actually, Shane Hensley's crew was selling it. And I bought it and I took it back, and my two friends that I was with, who are not war gamers by any stretch of the imagination, sat down with me in the lobby of the Hyatt place on the southwest side of Indianapolis there. And it's probably 1 a.m. We had come back in from dinner exhausted, but I said, damn it, I want to play this game. I sat down, and I think I must have spent 45 angry minutes looking for the rule that prevented the NGOs from using a WMD.
Well, I remember capturing Baghdad Airport by converting all the American soldiers there to be Sunni.
Obviously, they're swiping the whole mechanic from Dune. I get that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's fun, but I don't think it's anything like Baghdad.
Well, then this was sort of the source of my question. I mean, don't you at some point, you get a terrific mechanism that, as you correctly say, is a blast. And by the way, my friends who are not war gamers, as I say, or certainly not historians, they absolutely had a blast. They loved it. But I couldn't get over the fact of the dumb stuff I was able to do. And I just start to wonder that as we who want to reflect on things like sweat, like what you're talking about, collateral damage and conducting a military, you know, the natural instinct of people who don't know anything about war games is, well, shoot, I'm just going to go out there and smash these guys. And for you to step in with your designer hand and say, wait, I realize I gave you the most powerful set of forces in the history of the planet, but you can't use them all, because if you do, you'll actually lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The I've played Battle for Baghdad 3 times. I've never made it past turn 3 because somebody always ends up cutting some political deal in the middle of turn 2 to end the game very quickly. The first time I played it was me, 2 instructors from CGSC, a State Department guy, and a guy from NDU. And we're halfway into it, and Rex is like what you said. You know, we sort of looking at each other going, how the hell are we, like, you know, I was playing the, you know, one of the terrorist factions. And so when I get the WMD card, I'm going, hey, this is great. Except that I'm looking at that, I'm going, what happens if the Americans draw this? Like, are they really going to drop a nuke on some neighborhood in Baghdad? Like, there's the idea of the NGOs using a WMD never even crossed my mind until you brought it up just now. But just the idea that the Americans might legitimately nuke a neighborhood in Baghdad, I'm thinking there's not a chance in hell. And so at that point, if you sort of ignore the labels that are on many of the forces out there, it's not a bad game. It just doesn't, like you said, it doesn't model what it purports to model. I also want to come back to the point you were making earlier about, you know, trade-offs and balances and choices, and there's not always a right answer. There might be something that looks like the right answer right now, but 3 turns from now, those second and third order effects are going to come back to kick your ass. And that there's just sort of a series of what's the least bad thing that we can do out of all of this. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking you're describing a distant plane in all of that. You know, it's not sort of how do you win. It's how do you try to not lose?
Well, I think the success of the GMT coin series does highlight that you can very successfully produce a commercial hobby game that has an awful lot of pull mill in it, has a lot of politics, has a lot of political things happening, has interesting dynamics between competing sides, has political support modeled. All of the games in those series have very significant components in them which are about things that aren't kinetic, and that's a hugely successful series.
There's a couple of other things out, you know. Well, the first thing that I say about the coin games is, as Jim Will knows, I don't consider those war games.
Doug is correct.
You know, that's where I think you start to get into a little bit of what Jim is talking about here of you've got war gamers, and on the one hand, trying to attract people who aren't war gamers to play a war game. A serious war game may have a real uphill climb, but conversely, people who are hardcore war gamers may find a lot of games that are you know, what I call a coin game a war-themed Euro. You know, they're not appealing to me at all. I think there are a lot of people like me in the hobby, though they have been very successful games. I will agree with that. Hollenspiel is doing some really interesting stuff along these lines. They've got a couple of games out right now. One is an Infamous Traffic.
Yep.
Which is about the East India Company and the opium trade in China and the opium wars. But it's not food wars. It's the politics and the economics of that period. And then the other one has come out. Or is in the process of coming out. No, it's out. Is this the land, which is about the politics of slavery in America, leading up to the American Civil War.
That one was specifically called out in several of the articles about Scramble for Africa, several of the reactions about that one being a a much better way to treat a controversial topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's almost, I mean, I feel very strongly about this, so I'm going to say this. That's almost an offensive comparison. Yeah. I mean, because Tom tortured himself about this game for, I think by his accounting, 20 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Just trying to think about how to do this in a way that shows the reason. I've got the deluxe version with the map. It's an awful game to play, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Well, but that was the point that the articles were making, is that Tom had clearly put a lot of thought and a lot of deep thought and consideration into how do you broach such an awful topic in some sort of game form and do it in a way that is appropriately sensitive to the material, which it felt like, especially in the marketing materials, the Scramble for Africa folks had not.
Well, let's also be real direct. You had a middle-aged, he's younger than I am, so I should be respectful. You had a white male writing a game about slavery.
Yeah.
You know, which is, holy cow, is that a landmine? And by and large, I think he succeeded. But, you know, Doug, I want to throw into Doug's pile my favorite. I love This Guilty Land. I can't possibly enjoy it, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, it plays brilliantly. Boy, it's a tough game to play, though. A game I actually like to play, that again, to your point, it's more along these lines. Probably my favorite is John and Company.
Right, right.
Which goes deeply into some really interesting pieces of the history, especially if you play the very complicated full scenario. Which goes to the point at which the company's monopoly utterly fails, and suddenly it's this wild, free, Wild West thing that's ever, you know, and underneath all these things, of course, much as in the coin games, there's a war going on, right? John Company has the largest army in the world at the time, with the possible exception, certainly the largest Western army in the world, you know, so it's crazy. No, so there are some really good games coming out. I'm going to have to, all this by way of agreeing with Doug that those aren't war games.
So, Rex, I want to change topics here slightly and circle back around to We Are Coming Nineveh grew out of one of your game design courses in which, you know, you've got your students tackling some tough topics and how do we model these things in different games. What are some of the other kinds of games and topics that some of your students have tackled in some of these? I know you recently summed some of them up, some of this year's games up in a PacSims post.
So PacSims has got a list of the half dozen or so game projects we had this year. Some of them were very conventional war games. So, you know, a game, for example, on platoon-level modern urban operations, but designed to show the value or non-value of certain emerging capabilities and technologies. So it's a game in which it looks a bit urban operations-esque, but at the beginning you're deciding if you want to buy micro drones or powered armor or various other things that are currently in development or testing and whether it actually helps or not.
Is there a place I can buy powered armor?
No, you can't. When I play tested the game, they have a mechanism for it failing when you get hit. So it did save one of my guys in my fire team from dying, but then his servos froze up and the whole fire team then had to waste time trying to get him out of the armor before they could move again.
Yeah, see, the problem is I would be fixing it. That would be my role in the game.
Absolutely true. Small drones kept red off the roofs because they were too easily spotted once I had that kind of overhead coverage, but that the power armor looked great until one of them stopped working and the whole fire team had to stop and take it off the guy. So that's a very conventional topic. Some more Paul Mills stuff, for example, the Ukraine war, Russian hybrid warfare stuff, into stuff that's not wargaming at all. So there's a game on Mexican drug cartels in which you're competing drug cartels trying to secure drug smuggling routes from South and Central America up into the United States. There's a game on the sort of economics and geopolitics of climate change in the Arctic, resource exploitation, shipping routes, environmental protection, and what have you. So they really come up with a lot of interesting games. They do need to listen to me about building the prototype early and play testing a lot, but I will continue to repeat myself endlessly on it takes more time than you think to play test the game.
Isn't that every college student ever?
Well, they're using the term paper. They weren't too bad, but they're using a term paper model of we can pull it together the week before it's due. They're not quite that bad, but, you know, my constant lectures about you need to prototype super early because you're going to spend weeks and months tweaking it.
Yeah.
Jim and I just literally spent over a year playtesting a Friedland scenario in one game.
Yeah, scenario, not game, just scenario.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the designer just kept backing the French up and backing the French up.
Yeah.
Not that I'm bitter.
Rex is the source of a quote that I used quite a bit when I was teaching for a while there, which is, you know, this is due a week from Friday, which doesn't mean you have 10 days to ignore it and 2 days to panic, right? Start now. And so,
what works is an incentive system or a disincentive system. So the status report's going to be moved earlier in the term next year because when they have to do the status report because it's graded, then they need a prototype that they need to have play tested it. So I'm just going to move some of the graded components up earlier.
Are there any others besides We Are Coming Nineveh that are somewhere in the glide path for potential commercial release?
None of them are right now, but it's really a function of whether those students want to continue to work on it. So I said to some of the groups, if there's something you want to continue to work on, you know, I'm available. It needs a fair amount of polishing and tweaks and what have you, but I think you've got something here. The point is a lot of students tend to take that course just before they graduate. So you can have a group of four or five people, but then only one of them is on campus and the other three are elsewhere around the world, which can actually make it a bit difficult for these groups. And in the case of We Are Coming Nineveh, the actual game system worked pretty damn well, the one that was handed in. Harrison went off to KCL War Studies and is taking the wargaming course there. Juliet's in back in France right now, but, you know, they didn't have a lot. It was just small refinement after that, which was easier to do with people at different places. But there's certainly probably 3-4 games this year, which if the students want to work on them next year, they could produce something they could run past a publisher. There's some really, really clever ideas in there. Whether it was the way, you know, kinetic stuff was being modeled into some of the non-kinetic games. In the Meltdown one, the Arctic one, you actually have chunks of ice covering the board at the top, and they get removed in more or less an accurate pattern based on the predictions from global warming, and then you discover what resources might now be accessible. So you're actually removing the ice as it melts. So it's a long-term game.
That may be the answer to the question I was about to ask, but have you had anybody showing you, explaining a game, teaching a game, where you went, damn, that's a really cool idea?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. And students sometimes come up with really clever things. In the Cartel game, and here we're getting, you know, from in terms of narrative engagement rather than game system, the first version of it, you just wanted to get money to win the game. The final version of it, you turn your cash into luxury goods, and some luxury goods are worth more victory points than others, but you have a giant picture of your rich estate, and you're buying things for it, like sports cars and a shark aquarium.
Laser beams on their heads?
The game, I'm a drug smuggler, but damn, I want to get the shark aquarium before someone else buys it for my nice rich house. So I did like that. Everyone who's ever looked at that game has looked at all the cool stuff they can buy with their ill-gotten drug proceeds and wanted the shark aquarium.
Who wouldn't want to shit? I want to know, can you get sharks with laser beams on their heads?
That's often been asked. But, I mean, it's a serious game in which, you know, it's about smuggling dynamics, it's about influence, it's about bribing officials, and even once you've smuggled the stuff, you then have to have laundering mechanisms to get the money back. It's just a way of managing the victory points at the end to make sure that people don't hoard cash through the entire game. So it works super well. But it is really cool when you buy the shark aquarium.
We're rapidly approaching our hour here. Jim, parting thoughts.
No, I've always enjoyed the work. I've enjoyed following Pac Sims. It's a real pleasure to be on with Rex. And I think one of the things I think about, I know that one of the things I think about a lot as I look at Coop Cog is that I've had this passion, I've had this love, I've had this history thing that goes a long way. But what the CPX has taught me in my encounter with professional wargaming and the development of this hobby is it actually is a way of thinking that's built around real world problems. And the fact that the thing I really do cherish about it is you're not allowed to make easy answers or counterfactual answers. I am wearing a shirt right now that I got at the planetarium down in Chicago, and it's a professor in front of a chalkboard, and he's written an equation on the left, and over on the right he's got a conclusion after an equal sign, and right in between them he's got written, "And then a miracle occurs."
Yeah.
And the caption of the cartoon is, "I really need to talk to you about step two." And what I've experienced of professional wargaming and professional wargame design and thought is that you're not allowed to pretend a miracle occurs. You've got to deal with the issues of sweat, of engagement, of collateral damage, and still come up with things. And in my level, we talked for the longest time about, okay, if it really came down to it and the Milwaukee Common Council had to meet to approve an emergency bond issue for some disaster, what would you really need to stand up this government? And having that conversation with the people I work with and really having to answer that in a context was clarifying. Obviously, we got the plan done, but it was also very clarifying in terms of how much we have that we really don't need when you get right down to it. So that way of thinking, that way of planning, that piece of it, while I still have my love of history over here, has really given me something of value, and I really do appreciate it.
You know, it's interesting. Shortly after 9/11, I actually ended up, I had an op-ed published in a newspaper back in South Carolina when people were talking about turning on kind of the whole apocalypse bunker, right? The shadow government that's hiding in the foothills of the Appalachians in case D.C. gets nuked. And the whole gist of my op-ed was, look, if we can run the government with 300 dudes in a bunker in a hillside somewhere, can we just send the other 12 million people on the government payroll home? Right? Can we just do this with those 250 dudes and just call the rest of the government off, just shut it all down at that point?
Well, and as a Canadian observer of U.S. politics, it appears you do that from time to time.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's no question.
And let's be honest, fuck all gets done when that happens, right? I mean,
right.
But yeah, that, Jim, you talk about what's the minimum you need to keep going. That was sort of my sarcastic way of pointing out that, you know, you really, the minimum is more than you think, but probably not as much as the government thinks in a lot of cases. Doug, parting shots, any thoughts?
Just to kind of echo Jim a little bit. I mean, the first time that I ran across Pac Sims was revelatory because it made me realize that the thoughts that I had, that these games that I was playing actually had some meaning beyond the cardboard chits and learning about history, that there were actually people really doing this and in fact teaching classes about it, actually really made me feel quite happy that the world was learning from these things that I'd spent 20 years playing, and that they were more serious. And so I've always appreciated that about Pac Sims and about the things that Pac Sims talks about. It also made me realize, though, that I'm probably in a really weird niche. I mean, not that our hobby isn't already a niche hobby, but when you're the kind of player I am, where I'm really concerned about things other than, hey, can I take two armies and bash them together, you know, of a Sunday afternoon and have a lot of fun from it, means that, you know, now I'm not just on the wargamer side of things, which makes me a niche hobbyist, but I'm a niche within wargaming.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of us doing that.
So you're really niche.
What's that, Grant?
You're really niche.
Well, yeah, I mean, particularly on the hobbyist side, right? I don't have a firm... Jim's got a really direct tie to his job, and this is Rex's job. It's the thing that he does.
Yeah, pay me for it. It's pretty cool.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's pretty cool. And you know, honest to goodness, if I had known that I could maybe get somebody to pay me to do this 35 years ago, I'd have probably done it. I feel that way about Sterrett, too. Every time I look at him, I'm kind of like, man, I really, you knew something I didn't know, and I really wish I had known it. But, yeah, I think that for me, one of the things about all this is there are deeper things to think about here. And while, as a hobbyist, there are a lot of times we don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do have to at least acknowledge and be aware that when we are moving those chits around that hex map to represent a thing that happened in history, and we talk about how we want to learn about history, there are some really unpleasant things that happened as part of that. And we need to be mindful of those and not just, I'm not saying obsess about them, but we do need to be aware that they happened and that it is part of the history.
Yeah.
And that
absolutely.
Maybe we ought to learn from that sometimes.
Yeah. Rex, parting thoughts at all?
Well, I mean, I'll just say, since we did talk about the course, I will say it's enormously gratifying to see how students so quickly pick up that games are a way of you know, understanding military history or understanding geopolitics or understanding public policy issues where there are difficult choices. And the vast majority of the students in the conflict simulation design course are not war gamers. Probably the majority of them aren't even board gamers or Euro gamers in a major way. And they pick it up really quickly and they apply it really quickly. I do a course on peace operations and I've got 100 students who play for a week in a stabilization game. They pick up really quickly what it is games can offer. In addition to the, you know, us playing them for fun, they pick up really quickly on how the choices you make are illuminating stuff about capabilities and contexts and goals, resources and decision-making processes and so forth.
Yeah. One of these days, I hope some of your students get some of their games entered in some of the game design contests that some of the different conventions sponsor. Have them turn their stuff in for Kublai Khan or Dragon Con or one of the other places that run a game design contest just to see how they would do with something a little more serious. I'd just be curious to see what comes out of all that.
Interesting idea, yeah.
How they would fare against the pure hobbyists. So, guys, it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate everyone taking some time in the evening to join us on this. And to our audience, thanks for taking the time to listen to something that's not just how do we bash two armies together and what were the ugliest uniforms of the Napoleonic era. And so we do appreciate you taking the time for this. Thanks a bunch. Rex, we definitely want to talk to you again sometime down the line when you've got another batch of game designs to tell us all about. But maybe one of these days we'll just talk to you about one of your zombie mega games, too.
Oh. which had a lot of mayors and fire chiefs and municipal officials in it. So, yeah.
Excellent.
As the zombies or trying to control them?
Hey, I'm sitting right here.
That game was one-third municipal politics. It really was, yeah.
I know we're done, but I'm going to tell you, it often occurs to me, we believe it or not, we have discussed internally, not on the record, all right, let's turn this Koopcock discussion to zombie outbreak.
another podcast topic.
I can neither confirm nor deny that at one point when I was running data centers at a large public hospital that we had a contingency plan for how we would deal with staffing during a zombie outbreak to keep the hospital running.
There you go.
We had observers from the Canadian Joint Warfare Center at the zombie mega game. Their badges actually said Canadian Joint Zombie Warfare Center, but they were the real officers. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really sure where we go from there, so we're just going to say goodnight, and we'll take on the zombie topic maybe next season. So, Rex, thank you. Jim, thank you. Doug, thank you. Audience, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate all y'all, and we will catch you on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. Come check us out at armchairdragoons.com, and come find us at any of the conventions we'll be doing this year, not just Origins. We're planning to be at Mace in Charlotte. We're planning to be at Buckeye Game Fest. We're going to see what else we manage to wrangle up this year, and we're already starting to put together our target list for next year also. So thanks again, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.